instantaneously after he heard it, you know, they instantly fell in love with him.
Yeah, just such so much soul in it. It wasn't just playing. That was the thing.
Yeah.
There was so much more in it. Yeah.
About 6 weeks after he'd been over to England, I mean, he invited himself basically up on stage with the Cream. And after the second song, Eric walked off stage, I understand, and just had a cigarette and had to calm down.
Wow.
You know?
How do you compete against that? Well, how did he get to England? I mean, there he was in New York. Things were going along well.
Pretty good, pretty good. I mean, the pay at the Café Wa was terrible.
Oh.
Manny Roth, David Lee Roth's uncle, owned the Café Wa. And so I talked to one of the other club owners nearby there, and he says, Manny wouldn't pay these groups that he had in there nothing. He said they would have to come over to my place, and I'd give them a cheeseburger and fries, and you know, and just tell the waiter, just give it to her, just give it to them, you know. And so they would basically play the club, get a few dollars, and go over there and eat. So I mean, Jimmy was struggling, and eventually he found Keith Richards' girlfriend, Linda Keith, found Jimmy playing, and just, you know, fell in love with him literally and his playing. And wanted to use her connections, you know, especially with the Rolling Stones, got Andrew Oldham.
Oldham, yeah.
Pardon me, Andrew. Down to the club, to various clubs to see him, along with Seymour Stein, Andrew's partner, down there, of co-founder of Sire Records. Got them down there, and they really didn't see what Linda saw, or maybe she was a little too infatuated to really be Jimmy's publicist. So they passed. I mean, they had their hands full with the Rolling Stones. I mean, you know.
That's true.
You know, to take on Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones. And So she was coming out of a club one night, and incoming was Chaz Chandler of the Animals.
Yeah.
And Chaz finished up the final tour with his bit with the Animals and Eric Burdon and the Animals, and was looking to get into management, and was also at the same time blown away by Tim Rose's slowed down version of Hey Joe. So Linda Keith convinced him to come down to the Café Wa one afternoon, and Jimmy was playing, and so one of the first or second songs that Jimmy went into was Hey Joe. And Chaz's immediate reaction, he had a milkshake in front of him, spilled it all over himself, and said, oh my God, why hasn't somebody signed this guy up?
You know? Wow.
And as he finished up the tour, he started the ball rolling, and he and his co-manager, Michael Jeffrey, made the arrangements, bought up some of Jimmy's contracts that he had signed previously, and got him on board and said, well, hey, you want to come to England? You know, and one of Jimmy's stipulations, well, you know, do they have electric guitars there? He said, the Chaz seemed to think that Jimmy thought they were using gas guitars or gas-powered electric guitars or something like that. Jimmy's. So he signed up, and he got him over to England in the latter part of September of 1966.
Oh, okay. Well, should we, you brought some rarities along. Spin one?
Yeah. This one is a early version of Burning of the Midnight Lamp. Jimmy recorded this slightly after he debuted at the Monterey Pop, finished up the tour with the Monkees, which is a whole other story, and had this idea in his head of Burning of the Midnight Lamp. And if you don't know it, Jimmy kind of liked to play on piano. He was a pretty decent piano player. Not great, but, you know, decent. And so he had this harpsichord sound in his head. So he banged around on the harpsichord. And you can hear in this version that he really hasn't got the phrasing or the timing down with his vocals of where to, you know, this should drop in here and this drop here. But it's a fun version, and there's a early guitar solo. This version wasn't used for the finished product, but you can just see a work in progress with Jimmy.
Oh, lovely.
Little more than enough to make a man throw himself away. And I continue to burn the midnight lamp. Doesn't bother me too much at all. It's just the ever-falling dust that makes it so hard for me to see that forgotten earring laying on the floor, facing coldly towards the door. And I continue to burn the midnight lamp. Oh, no.
That was great. So, like, underwater stuff there.
Jimmy playing with his new toy, the wah-wah pedal.
Can't get enough of it.
Yeah. In fact, in our RU experience, he hadn't, you know, the wah-wah pedal hadn't come into play yet for him. I mean, he heard it on Tales of Brave Ulysses on the Cream's Disraeli Gear album. And so, you know, he wanted to try that sound too. So, you know,
So,
I mean, so he was using the tremolo arm on the guitar instead of the wah-wah pedal. So for Axis Bold's Love, which came out, or which he started working on later that year, that's when he started using the wah-wah pedal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that was something new he did learn then.
Yeah. Oh.
He didn't know everything.
Yeah. Then he came across a guy named Roger Mayer, who started building, you know, these experimental devices. You know, and Jimmy had all these wild science fiction sounds in his head, and he wanted to reproduce them on the guitar. And he wanted, you know, a sound that would crossfade from back and forth from channel to channel. And, you know, he had ideas of quadraphonic sound before there was quadraphonic sound. But, you know, he was limited to stereo. So, I mean, through Roger Mary, you know, he was able to get some of these effects out of his guitar.
Was that in England?
Guy did. Roger Mayer was a, let's see if I can get it right. He worked for the British Navy, and he was into sonar devices and underwater sounds. You know, perfect choice for Jimmy. And so he got into rock and roll music and started building these devices. I think for also Jimmy Page, too, that they would get these kind of weird, freaky guitar sounds.
Oh, wow, they're competing against each other to get the weirdest thing. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
But now, okay, we've come to England, and now I interviewed Brian Auger about a month ago, and he was at the nightclub where Jimi Hendrix first played, where Eric Clapton was there. Ronnie Scott's, maybe it was. I'm not sure where it was. Was it Ronnie Scott's?
I don't think so. I don't think it was
Ronnie
Scott.
Maybe not. He may not have been open by then, yeah.
I think I have a tape of that, though.
Okay.
But that, John Mayall was there too that night, I think, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and I know Brian said that that Clapton said that, you know, when Clapton heard me, he said he went home and he was considering giving up the guitar. Yeah. I mean, he just didn't know where to go. He was like so puny, he felt, compared to what Jimmy had done.
Yeah, really? God, definitely.
And that's a man they call God.
With a small G.
Right, right. So now... So he got to England, and suddenly, Chaz Chandler was handling his management. And so, how did they put together the experience? How did they package him?
Well, they wanted to go with this, unfortunately, this wild man from Borneo look, you know, frizzed out hair, you know, girl, mothers hide your daughters kind of look. Jimi Hendrix is in town, and you know, they would go out of their way to photograph him kind of in a dark, moody kind of thing. And, you know, he played into that image. He would wear capes and, you know, just have this brooding look. But, you know, that really wasn't Jimmy. I mean, he was a friendly, easygoing, funny guy. But, you know, this is the image that they felt, Chaz Chandler and co-manager Michael Jeffrey felt that they should do that. And so they started with Hey Joe. And as I'm sure you're aware, but, you know, it got airplay on, was it Radio Carolina, I believe it was?
Right, the Pirates, yeah.
Pirate stations there. Yeah. And they also, too, they went into the record stores and they bought up tons of amounts of the records so that it would go up to the charts. And you can't do that these days.
Yeah.
But, and so, you know, it followed from there. And Jimmy started developing this idea for the second single, Purple Haze. Mm. And, in fact, Jimmy tells the story himself in this great interview that... originally, you know, there were thousands and thousands of pages for the song Purple Haze that he started sketching out around Christmas time of 1966. And about he had this dream of going underwater in this mythical land. And actually, the first version of Purple Haze that he sketched on paper was called Purple Haze Jesus Saves.
Ooh. Huh.
Yeah, it was very dark and had different meanings there. But the unique thing about that song is what's been known is what has become known as the Jimi Hendrix chord. I think it's the E flat seventh ninth. I'm not a guitar player, but I better learn how to become one, because this October 25th we're going to have 3,000 guitar players, and I'm going to be one of them.
All right. Yeah.
But so anyway, he developed. Purple Haze, which has this strange Hendrix chord in it, and it's funny. It charted over in England, but here in the States, when it finally hit the airwaves, slightly before Monterey Pop, the Monterey Pop Festival, it didn't break the top 40. Except, he said, in the Bay Area, and I found I don't know if you remember a station called KFRC.
Oh yes,
the big 610. It got to number three around July of 1967.
Huh.
Number three. I mean, like it surpassed the Beatles. I think All You Need Is Love. I forget exactly what the Beatles hit was then.
Mm-hmm.
But number three in San Francisco during the Summer of Love. How perfect.
Whoa.
But the rest of the nation obviously fell behind the West Coast at that time, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that was the thing. Jimmy came to Monterey with really nobody knowing about him in America. Yeah. Wasn't that the case?
That was the case. I mean, he didn't even have a record label. Mm-hmm. Warner Reprise eventually came in on board. And just after the Monterey Pop debut, his American debut, he wasn't doing it otherwise, you know. So, and setting his guitar on fire for the second time, Bill Graham heard about him and invited him to be a opening act for Jefferson Airplane for a full week at the Fillmore West.
Mm.
And the story goes is that after the second or third day, Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, Paul Kander, and the rest, it's like, we can't compete with this guy. And they, Gracie got a cold and couldn't play. And Big Brother, Janice, Big Brother and the Holding Company came and were an opening act for the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh,
and one of the things that inspired me to do this world's largest guitar ensemble this year later in San Francisco was that on June 25th, finishing up that final week in San Francisco there, Jimmy played a free concert in Golden Gate Park. And it happened to be the same day that the Beatles did a world satellite broadcast, one of the first simulcasts of All You Need Is Love.
I watched it from England.
Yeah. It all happened on the same day. So wow. My original plan was to do it on June 25th this year. And we decided, well, let's tie it in with Woodstock. But, that's kind of the story of Purple Haze.
Oh, interesting. Well, a lot was going on in that year.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everywhere. It was unbelievable.
It was a fun, exciting year. Oh, man.
Indeed. Yeah, talking about All You Need Is Love, I always remember that because the day after there was, people stood up in Parliament. They were just shocked, at the depravity that the Beatles showed. You know, it was like all these flowers and everyone singing, because every country had their own little bit. Like the French, they had somebody doing the accordion.
Yeah, right.
The Germans had the Lederhosen, uh-huh. And there was the Beatles doing All You Need Is Love.
They found that insulting?
Yeah, it didn't properly show Britain in the proper light.
But I'm sure they've changed their minds.
I think so, yeah. I think so. Going back to Brenda, I want to pose this question as you are
it's
a total...
The teacher gets tested.
Yeah, get the stress going. Now, this is a question. This is the most ridiculous pairing of a gig with Jimi Hendrix. Who was the most ridiculous person that they paired with? And it happened in England in 67.
Oh, I'm getting clues.
Okay. And
the most ridiculous pairing?
Yes. You wouldn't think in a million years they would actually be on the same show.
Engelbert Humperdinck is my guess.
You got it.
And what did he win, Johnny? Well, I'm actually on that bill, to be fair. It was Cat Stevens and the Walker Brothers. And Noel's... what's his name? I want to say his real name. Jerry Ragavoy was, what's his name? I forgot. Engelbert, thank you.
Oh, Jerry Dorsey.
That was his real name.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't know why that stuck in my head. Random facts floating around in space here. Must be that strange smell I smell.
It's the paella, yeah.
And that's it. Yeah, something you're cooking at the farmer's market.
Yeah.
But anyway, he lost his bass player, and so Noel... So Noel sat backstage and played guitar for Engelbert Humperdinck, and also played bass with the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Now that's a strange, mind-blowing interview.
Yeah. Lots of trivia.
Hey, this man knows his Hendrix because not many people know that one, so he has passed the test.
Ooh, okay.
One thing my wife asked is one thing she wanted to know. Who was Foxy Lady written about?
Ah, that's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked that. We have a story about my wife that I could tell you about that involves the Foxy Lady.
Okay.
But we won't get into that. Excuse me. Foxy Lady was also the name of Jimmy had two cats. In 1966, and he named them Foxy, and so it kind of comes from there. But all the girlfriends I interview, depending on what song it is, they say the song was written about them.
Okay.
And I think it's a combination of a lot of different women that crossed Jimmy's paths in 66 and 67. I'm kind of leaning toward Kathy Etchingham, although I think the song was in its embryonic stages in 66 when he was seeing Lithophane Pridgeon, Linda Keith, Diana Carpenter, Carol Shirokey.
Oh my God. You even got all his girlfriends.
Take your pick, Carol. I mean, if they were all in this room, they would raise their hand. It was about me. I don't care what you said. And I've been in a room with this. Actually, that's another story. Excuse me.
That sounds interesting. Should we play another rarity?
Please.
What one should I put on?
Well, let's have some fun here. Let's do track 6. This is I Don't Live Today, and this is the regular version. However, this is an isolated track. All we're going to hear is the lead vocal track of Jimmy, and of course, and the lead guitar. So the drums and the bass are down there. So we get to focus on Jimmy's guitar playing and his wonderful singing.
Okay.
Will I live tomorrow?
Well, I just can't say. Will I live tomorrow? Well, I just can't say. But I know for sure I don't live today. No sun coming through my windows. Feel like I'm living at the bottom of a grave. No sun coming through my windows. Feel like I'm living at the bottom of a grave. I wish you'd hurry up and execute me, so I can be on my miserable way. Well, I don't live today. Maybe tomorrow. I just can't say, but I don't live today. It's such a shame to waste your time away like this. Existing. Well, I don't live today. Maybe tomorrow. I just can't tell you, baby, but I don't live today. It's such a shame to spend the time away like this. Existing.
Experienced.
Wow, did that come from just the name of what came first, the name of the group or the song?
I don't live today, you mean?
Are you experienced? Sorry, I was jumping to the are you experienced. Did he just use it because it was the experience, or
a little play on words? But also, are you experienced has a different connotation. Especially right. In 1967, if you had taken the drug,
right,
you were experienced, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I don't live today. A quick story about that. Jimmy often dedicated it to the Native Americans in the audience and anywhere. In fact, he was part Cherokee himself, and so he had a Native American background. And it's about their struggles and everything like that on the reservations. And in fact, in some interviews, he talks about, seeing them on Skid Row and drinking too much and, you know, trying to help them. And so trying to shed some light on them, you know, kind of that no other rock group had done at the time, you know, talking about them.
Did he experience much racial prejudice, in his going around touring and things?
Well, even early starting out, in fact, one of the great things I discovered in the new book I'm writing on called Before London, is that he was arrested along with Billy Cox for sitting in a whites-only section in Nashville. Nashville, as my co-author and I have discovered, was kind of the center for kind of a testing ground in the early 60s, 1962 to be exact, not Greensboro, South Carolina, where they were doing sit-ins and things like that. So, and Jimmy kind of jokes about it in some interviews, saying that, you know, he and his friends would take a lunch and watch the riots on Sundays, you know, the whites and the blacks going at each other. So Jimmy and Billy Cox decided to push it a step further, and they went in a one of the lunch counters and sat in a whites-only section and were arrested. And, in fact, there's a letter home that Jimmy writes to his father telling him, you know, what had happened. You know, he had to get bailed out. The owner of the Del Morocco Club bailed him and Jimmy out. And, you know, there was his talent there. He had to get them out of jail. But so, and there's a great letter that goes back from Jimmy's father to Jimmy saying, you know, hey, I've done similar things myself in my lifetime here in Seattle, and I'm glad you stood up for your rights and, you know, defended your race, you know, that, you know, the silliness of segregation, especially in the South there, and too. And he experienced it, there I go with his pun, when he was touring the South with the experience. And, you know, here's this African-American guy with wild hair, pinwheels for eyes, you know, and looking at the blonde girls at the convenience store and everything like that. You know, so he did, you know, he would have to stay in the limousine, and Mitch and Noel would have to go out and get the food at the restaurant and bring it back in. And, you know, because, you know, those guys would kill him, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible. Well, you're listening to Cowles Radio, 107.3 FM, coming to you from Verdant, downtown Occidental. And you're listening to Steve Roby, a historian and archivist and lecturer on Jimi Hendrix. If you haven't guessed, we've been playing some great rarities. We'll play some more, which Steve has brought in. You can give us a call at area code 707-874-1073. And we're here for the next about 55 minutes, and we'll be playing more Hendrix, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So why not? And excuse me. Now, one thing, talk about his family. What type of relationship did he have? You mentioned his brother, who sounded like an influence on him,
Leon,
and his father.
Yeah, Leon was a little younger than Jimmy. And so, actually, he ended up being kind of a father to Leon in many respects. I mean, Al was busy all day working in the landscape business, and the two of them were kind of had to take care of each other. Jimmy, Jimmy was into recycling back then.
That's, the 8 o'clock dump of the recycling from Howard's Cafe.
Okay, check your watches now. Anyway. Kind of a sad story. They were broke. They were hungry. Money was tight. His father was drinking. The mother had deceased and moved on. And Jimmy would go into like a Safeway back then and would steal a couple of slices of bread and then go over to the deli counter and open up some bologna and feed his brother Leon. And in fact, money was so tight that Leon... they had to put in a foster home because Al couldn't afford to take care of the both kids there. And another son came along, Joe, who had some disabilities, some physical disabilities. And in the documentary that I just showed my class last Tuesday, we get to see Joe Hendrix, Jimmy's brother, and really looks like him, despite some of the deformities there. Tells a story, kind of a sad story, that when he was 3 years old, that, you know, the parents... gave him some ice cream, a nice lunch, and everything like that, and then packed his suitcase and said, "Well, you're going to be going away for a little while, Joe," and just left him at, you know, with some foster parents.
Oh.
And so, you know, Jimmy really never got to see his brother Joe ever again. Yeah.
Oh, really? Just like went on.
That, yeah. And some other family stories. After Lucille's death, Al remarried in 1966 to a Japanese lady, June Ayoko. And she had several daughters, but Al adopted one of them, and her name was Janie, and Janie Hendrix, which she now runs the corporation called Experience Hendrix LLC in Seattle.
Okay.
So she's the lady in charge.
Hmm.
My former boss, actually.
Oh, okay. proper disclosure.
That's a whole nother story.
Okay. Well, let's play some more.
Yeah.
What else have you brought in?
Oh, lots of good stuff here. Let's go over to Germany on track 7. Mm. We'll hear Hey Joe that we've been talking about. This comes from a TV show, German TV. You guys over in Europe really had great TV. I mean, we had American Bandstand.
Oh, right.
I mean, Hullabaloo, Shindig. But I mean, some of the clips I've seen from European TV and the close-ups and, the different bands. I mean, we were stuck on the Turtles, for God's sake. And, I mean, forgive us, my God. But, excuse me, this comes from the Beat Club. March 2nd, 1967, in Bremen, Germany. And take it away.
Okay.
Sounds, real psychedelic sounds from the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh, real psychedelic sounds.
Okay, so they were corny announcers. Okay. But, I don't think he knew what psychedelic meant, but it sounded good. Yeah.
Exactly. The latest word. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about the BBC.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And people getting banned by the BBC. And a quick little story about Jimmy getting banned by the BBC. It was in 1969. There was a show you might even recall called Happening for Lulu.
Oh, no.
Remember Lulu?
Lulu, yes.
Yeah. A whole bit there. Lulu had her own show. I think it was a half-hour show. Mm-hmm. And the Jimi Hendrix Experience was a guest on it. It was early 1969, I want to say January. And so the plan was, on paper, that the Jimi Hendrix Experience would come out and play Voodoo Child Slight Return, because Electric Ladyland just was still in the charts, doing quite well. And she and Jimmy would do a duet together, you know. And a funny thing, though, is the year before on Dusty Springfield's show over in England, she and Jimmy did Mockingbird together. Yeah, and a little tape of that exists.
Oh, I'd like to see that one. Yeah.
And so, anyway, they were going to do the close out the show with a duet together, and bam, bam, roll the credits. And I interviewed the producer of the show, Stanley Dorfman, who went on to do a lot of great other things. But Stanley was telling me that, so after Voodoo Child, Jimmy plays Hey Joe, go into the duet with Lulu, boom, 5 o'clock news comes on. Right on time. Never been late. So Jimmy, in his own mind, says, I don't want to do a duet with Lulu. So he decides to pull the strings there. And from Hey Joe, which the shortest version of Hey Joe he's ever done in his life, he goes right into, says, the Cream had just broken up, late 68.
Oh.
So he dedicates a song to the Cream. He says, you know, to Jack Bruce, Ginger Baker, Eric Clapton, like to dedicate this song to Cream. Goes right into Sunshine of Your Love. And if you watch the video, you can see it on YouTube there. He says, Stanley Dorfman, and Stanley Dorfman was telling me, he says, he's pulling out his hair, he's going, cut, 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 Jimmy, we got to go. You know, and Jimmy at one point says in the microphone, he says, we're being put off the air. We're going. And Stanley was literally ready to pull a plug on Jimmy, because, you know, 5 o'clock news and they're ready to go on. Oh, you know, news of the day, and I assume that was prestigious, serious 5 o'clock news at night. And so Jimmy made the show run into overtime, and the news was late. It didn't start right at 5. So the punishment was, you're banned from the BBC.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
Yeah. Like it really meant anything.
Well, that's it. You know, say half the time people liked it. You know, they banned All Day and All of the Night from the Kinks.
Oh,
Wild Thing they banned. Mm. You know, 8 Miles High they banned, all those. It didn't take much. A drop of a hat, they were banning it.
Probably, I think, Sgt. Pepper parts of it too, right?
Well, most probably, I suppose. There was some stuff.
References to drugs and things like that.
Exactly, yeah. But then, you know, luckily the pirate boats came in the 60s, and so that broke the BBC monopoly, and so they played, of course, all the stuff that got banned by the BBC. And did very well, thank you.
Good for them. We need more of those stations.
Indeed. In fact, there's a film coming out, actually, in August, I believe.
Really?
About Radio Caroline, I think.
Oh, nice. Can't wait for that, yeah.
Yeah, it should be really super. It's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And now, did Jimmy hang out with all the other celebrities and rock stars? Were they like, did he keep to himself, or was he, you know, hanging out with Cream, or, you know, Clapton?
Eric was a good buddy. Occasionally Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend. But, you know, since America was his homeland, I mean, he would definitely wanted to spend more time here. I mean, New York was kind of like a second home, as was England. Of course, he had ties with Kathy Etchingham, his girlfriend, in England. And they bought a flat over there, which turned out to be connected to Handel's house, where Handel wrote all the music. And in fact, they have a blue plaque there honoring that house. Jimi Hendrix lived here and recorded music and wrote music. And so it's still honored there on Brook Street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And when he worked on his songs, did he just like use a little reel-to-reel and just play with music? Or how did he work up his work?
Well, Jimmy, the unique thing about him was he couldn't read or write music. And a lot of his music, if you will, was written out instruction-wise to him. A lot of it was actually, a lot of the papers were auctioned off in the 80s and 90s. Hmm. And, you know, in great detail, you know, he would say, singers come in here, and this, you know, this, and a lot of scratching out. But you'll never find, like, sheet music with Jimmy putting notes on it and everything like that. Mm. It was all in his head, and he had to lay down these demos. In fact, he was his own best bootlegger. He would bring a reel-to-reel tape to a lot of his shows. In fact, he recorded a show in Ottawa, Canada, and did a pretty decent job. And he was behind, I don't know if you ever heard the tape with Jim Morrison. And
no.
You've never heard the tape with a drunk, a very, very drunk Jim Morrison and Jimmy on stage. And Jim is going through the whole George Carlin list of seven the words you can't say on radio or TV and fitting them into songs. And Jimmy's trying to play Red House. And Jim is just screaming and moaning. And then Jimmy goes into Tomorrow Never Knows. And Jim's off on another tangent. It's hard to listen to. I mean, it was bootlegged terribly. But it's just one of those things Hendrix fans don't like to talk about.
Yeah. But amazing to have them together.
But you know, my point being is that there are a lot of tapes that Jimmy recorded in his hotel room. There's a whole tape of, in fact, one just recently auctioned off of demos for Electric Ladyland. Mm. Some acoustic, some electric with the amp turned down real low. And some songs that never ever got finished, one called Snowballs on My Window, and a few others there that can't come to mind there. But, you know, these the great lost recordings. And yeah. In fact, that's the subtitle to my first book. It's called The Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix. I've run across a lot of girlfriends and friends that had these tapes in their attics and basements and back drawers. And in fact, one lady, very nice lady, Melinda Merriweather, met Jimmy on Hawaii in 1970, and they had kind of a short love romantic affair together. But in kind of honor to Melinda, he wrote a 27-minute song to her called Scorpio Woman. And she was Scorpio, obviously, the zodiac sign there. And it's like 27 minutes of unreleased Jimmy, and here's the cassette. Thank you, Linda. I had a wonderful 2 weeks together with you on Maui.
And,
yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It'd be like
a Mozart piece.
Yeah, exactly.
Being
like I was going to say Picasso, painting a picture and just, you know, signing it to you.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So let's play some more rarities.
Yeah.
It'd be great.
Let's do
love it.
Track 12. This is a version of Isabella, one of the songs Jimmy was working on in 1969 with what was soon to become formed as and as known as the Band of Gypsies, with Buddy Miles on drums, Billy Cox on bass. And this version here is instrumental. Buddy's playing organ. So some of the other versions you hear, you won't hear an organ player on it. Mm. But the guys are kicking it. They're getting in more kind of a funk R&B groove.
Mm. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Yes. What was that called?
Called Isabella. The Band of Gypsies in the studio in 1969. To be exact, November 7th, 1969. Just a little over a month before they played the Fillmore East at Bill Graham's Fillmore East. And incredible 3 days, 4 days, I believe it was, at the Fillmore East. And that's supposed to, their entire set is actually supposed to be coming out very soon on CD. Entire shows, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Officially.
Oh, okay.
It's been out in other forms for years.
Oh, okay. Okay. But now, let's go back to the Monterey Pop.
I got my bags packed. I'm ready.
I know. Because that was pretty big. It was the introduction to America for Hendrix. But then there was this thing. It was Hendrix and The Who were the two final people meant to go on, and there was a huge battle about who was going to be on last. No, either Hendrix or The Who didn't want to be the last ones to go on because they knew that they would bust up all their instruments and all that sort of stuff, and they wanted to be the first one to do it. So I understand there was a big argument backstage.
I don't know how big the argument was there. I think it got blown out of proportion there. I don't know which one was kind of ready mentally and physically to take the stage there. Some people told me that prior to Jimmy going on, people were just plunking tabs of acid into his open can of Coke there, you know. So he was pretty high when he hit the stage there, but wow. Sounded incredible, though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he had to top. I mean, it's hard to top The Who. I mean, not many people normally top The Who, but he did.
It was kind of a debut for them, too, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah.
They got some airplay, as I recall, in America, but they really hadn't got the exposure like some of the other British groups. Yeah,
yeah, that was really their big break. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So both of them just, it seemed like they were vying.
I remember, as it sticks in my head, is Keith Moon's bass drum toppling forward into the crowd and cymbals clashing down on the stage there.
Smoke and flames.
Yeah.
They don't make, it's amazing, like everyone I've interviewed has a Keith Moon story. It's amazing.
Yeah, good old Keith. Mm.
Oh, dear. So, one thing, obviously he was a ladies' man, Jimmy. And one thing, a few years back, I saw the film Plaster Casters.
Oh, yeah, Cynthia Plaster, yes, I know.
Yeah, and, you know, so what's the story behind that? And where is his plaster mold?
Cynthia has gotten back her plaster mold of several rock stars, including Jimmy's. And you can actually definitely take a trip to Cynthia's Plaster Caster website. You will be entertained. It's maybe a PG rating website. Cynthia, though, I differ with on, I don't know if you're aware of, there was a Jimi Hendrix sex tape film that was released on DVD last year. In fact, I was contacted to authenticate it and was given a special secret code to go to this website and type in this number, and I could watch the scenes. Before anybody else could see it, you know. And then, they wanted, well, yes, that is Jimi Hendrix, you know, I recognize him. And what I saw was just some African-American guy with a headband on his head that sort of looked like Jimmy. I mean, it was filmed okay, and two girls entertaining him. But Cynthia saw it from a different viewpoint than I have, and obviously she held different parts of Jimmy's body than most people have. You'll probably have to go on website to get Cynthia's background and what we're talking about. But she claims that is definitely Jimmy. I don't see Jimmy. A lot of people don't see Jimmy in that video. And it was kind of disgusting. I mean, even the cover, they'd taken this original photo of Jimmy and Kathy Etchingham sitting on the bed together and superimposed this other person's face over Kathy Etchingham's face, and, you know, gave it the sex angle, and it's like, now you can see Jimi Hendrix prime. But the thing about it was, Jimmy was making those kind of films, but this wasn't one of them. he would call these the goodbye films. He would, spend a night with a different groupie in a different town and had an 8mm or a super 8mm, portable camera, what they had back then, and would take various scenes with his movie camera, and then, you know, put them all, splice them all together, and then invite his musician friends over, and they would watch these girls. And the reason they were called goodbye films is what he made them after the evening, the morning after, and then the morning after, would wave goodbye to him. And so there would be a collection of goodbye films. And there's another kind of slightly related story, too, of when Jimmy was living in the village. He didn't have a suitcase and kept his underwear and some clothing and his guitar all in a guitar case. But he would also, when a Polaroid camera was handy, I know my wife is thinking, how's he going to get through this story? Because she knows the story. He would take various pictures of young ladies entertaining him down below, and he would keep a collection of these in his guitar case.
Oh.
Like any healthy young man does. Most guitar players do. So he was a he was a collector of, of his own pornography, I guess you would say.
Indeed, yeah. He enjoyed it.
How'd I do?
He played his own ukulele, they say.
Or trombone.
Or trombone. Well, let's play some more Hendrix, shall
Excellent.
We? Another rarity. What you got?
Well, how much time do we got here?
We got 25 minutes.
Okay, let's go track 11, Easy Rider.
Okay. We'll be right back. fade down a bit on Jimmy. That's a nice extended jam there of his.
Yeah, Easy Rider it started out to be, and then just kind of went into this very loose, kind of fun, exploratory jam.
Nice. Yeah. That's nice. It was the whole thing's about 18, 19 minutes. Yeah. That's nice.
It goes on and on.
Indeed. Where would he would have gone? You know, he was changing, mm-hmm. Jimmy. You know, in the last year, he mm-hmm. wasn't doing, you know, just his normal things.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
So you know, where would he have gone? Do you think if he'd you know survived? Where do you think he would have moved into?
We start to see some of that change come in the middle of 1969, when he meets a producer named Alan Douglas. Alan Douglas was into had a good, strong jazz background and was involved with a jazz label at the time. And Michael Jeffrey, Chas Chandler had left the scene after while Electric Ladyland was going on. And Jimmy was out without a record producer and kind of on his own. And a lot of the material that was in the studio really wasn't guided. So Alan Douglas had met him in New York and stepped in and got him involved with a jam with John McLaughlin. Hmm. And there's a wonderful, almost a two-hour tape of the two of them jamming it together. And there's some great jams with Larry Young, a jazz player on Oregon. And there was going to be a formal session with Miles Davis set up in New York at the time. And it got as far as Miles inviting Jimmy back to his apartment, and Miles had some rough ideas, and there's a rumor that there is a tape that exists that Miles kind of just made a rough recording, a reference recording, if you will, of the two of them practicing in his apartment. But the funny story is that Miles had his horn, of course, and he passed Jimmy some sheet music and said, "Here, I want you to play this part here, and we'll go along, and I'll play the trumpet." And so Miles starts to play, and Jimmy looks at the sheet music and goes, "Miles, I don't read music." as Miles tells in his biography, that Jimmy caught on really fast, and they you know, they got along. But the formal session that Alan Douglas had set up in 1969 was ready to go. Jimmy was down there at the record plant, ready to record, and no Miles Davis, and no Miles Davis drummer, which I believe was I want to say Elvin Jones at the time, I think. And they had some other session players. And they were ready to go and ready to lay the tapes down. Engineers ready, producers ready. But Miles doesn't show up. Miles gives a phone call to Alan Douglas and says, I need $50,000 before I can come down there. That's the best Miles Davis I've
ever. Pretty good.
There was probably some other words I can't say that Miles would say in there. But use your imagination, kids. Excuse me. So Miles says, "Well, no way am I going to come down there unless I get $50,000." And, you know, $50,000 was a good deal of money back then. Yeah. And, you know, all of us would have chipped in to hear Miles and Jimmy playing. So anyway, not knowing what had happened, Miles' drummer calls and asks for the same amount just slightly a few minutes later and says, "Well, I ain't coming down to the session, you know, unless I get 50 grand." And I said, "Forget it. The session's off.
Whoa.
It's not going to happen." But in 1970, right after the Isle of Wight Festival, which Miles Davis was a part of too, they had made plans and were going to get together. Gil Evans was going to do some of the arrangements there. And it was definitely moving into a jazz direction for Jimmy. He wanted to kind of break away from the familiar pop rock format that, you know, the trio there wanted to get into big bands. A bigger band sound, sort of a jazz fusion sound. And there was even plans to send him to the Juilliard School of Music in New York.
Right.
So he could learn arrangements and write music and take some of these great ideas that he had in his head. So I'm sure we would have seen, I mean, if you listen to some of the Miles Davis albums, like In a Silent Way or Bitches Brew or Children on the Corner, and you can kind of imagine Jimmy playing along with that. Hmm. You know, obviously the direction of rock or jazz rock at that time would have definitely taken a different direction with Jimmy on board, you know.
That's a very good point, actually. Yeah. He would have pushed it, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Now, 69, obviously, was a very pivotal point for him in terms of Woodstock.
Absolutely,
I mean, that was...
He was the headliner.
He actually was the...
The headliner and got paid the most amount of money. In fact,
really?
Some of the other groups found out what he was going to get paid. And he said, "Wow, if Jimi Hendrix is getting that, you know, I should get that too." But the unfortunate thing was, with all the rain and the chaos and the tons of people that they didn't expect, Jimmy had to go on Monday morning. It was a 3-day festival. It's supposed to end Sunday night. Jimmy's supposed to close the show. Bad weather, trying to get the groups where they were at their hotels or in little tents backstage to the stage on time. Hmm. And it didn't happen Sunday night. So Jimmy goes on, I believe it was 5 in the morning. One of the instructors at College of Marin tells me, Kathy. Well, whatever her, yeah. her title is, but she works at the College of Marin.
Okay.
She was telling me that she woke up in her sleeping bag at like 5 or 6 in the morning. Jimmy, you know, going in to start playing, and she gave Jimmy the finger and started yelling at him and saying, you know, I wanted to sleep in 3 days of sex, drug, and rock and roll. And Jimi Hendrix waking up to Jimi Hendrix at 6 in the morning, you know. And if you see the closing scenes of the film, they're all the muck and the garbage.
Right.
But, an incredible performance that he gave.
Yeah, I mean, had he performed that before?
The Star Spangled Banner?
Yeah, was that part of, because I don't remember it when I saw him, mm-hmm. but...
You can start to hear that in just early, even at Monterey, he says, I'd like to play the American anthem and British anthem combined, sort of jokingly, but never really goes into it, and of course then plays Wild Thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, I mean, the Trogs are British and, you know,
right.
whatever. But, I mean, yeah, you do start to hear him, start to sneak it into shows, you know, but not as wild as it was on Woodstock.
That was over. He definitely took it and then just went with it.
Went with it. Well, it was an experimental group that he was playing with at the time, a short-lived group called Gypsy Sun and Rainbows that were actually billed as the Jimi Hendrix Experience, but Jimmy wanted to call them Gypsy Sun and Rainbows. He brought in two percussionists at the time. Excuse me. Throat is really dry. What do you
mean? Hey, grab some...
But anyway, he brought in two percussionists, Jerry Velez and Juma Sultan. Brought back his bass player friend from the Army, Billy Cox, and old Army friend Larry Lee to play rhythm guitar. So, I mean, he had, you know, 5-6 guys on stage, and Mitchell, of course. And they had only jammed for a couple of weeks, and here they are playing one of the largest rock concerts ever in Woodstock.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what an amazing, I mean, when you think of the trajectory of his career, I mean, it was just a few short years.
It was. about 4 years with Experience, about 3 or 4, maybe even 5 albums put out during his lifetime. But, you know, the fun part about it for me as an archivist historian of Hendrix's work is working on this book now on his R&B years and discovering a whole different side of Jimmy, new names, new people, new stories. And, you know, and some of the human frailties that that unfortunately, the demons inside us that are all inside us that come out in this book.
Right. You know, obviously you must, I mean, it's amazing the insights you've had in terms of interviews. Do you have a good picture of the man?
I think I do. No? You know, I thought I did with the first book, and when I started this book on the early years, I thought, well, you know, this won't be bad, and I'll get to show some different sides of Jimmy. And then, you know, all of a sudden, the list of number of people that I've interviewed so far for this book, which I hope to be out next year, is over 100 now.
Mm.
And, you know, luckily I've found a lot of these people alive and close girlfriends that live not too far away. And have great stories to tell, and the memories are good, you know, for the most part, yeah.
Like, how was he as a person? Was he fun to be with? Was he jokey? Was he serious?
Funny guy, kind of inward, quiet guy. But once you got to know him, one of the great stories of a guy just recently interviewed a couple of weeks ago in Las Vegas, a guy named Dean Courtney, a singer. You know, there were a lot of these wannabe up-and-coming singers in New York at the time that Jimmy was hanging out with. And he said that Jimmy spoke in a cartoon voice, cartoon character at the time, named Snagglepuss.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Snagglepuss?
Yeah.
Exit stage right and heavens to Murgatroyd. And Jimmy would always talk in a Snagglepuss voice. And, it was one of the nicknames that he got at the time. They were, you know, he had all these nicknames. And just a funny guy. He would sleep on this apartment in Greenwich Village out on the fire escape ledge there and would get up early in the morning and his hair would be all frizzed out and he would grab a Coke model and pretend that he was a DJ. And the room was just filled with, you know, 12 musicians at the time and just wake everybody up. And do this wild, crazy DJ waking everybody up.
Oh, fun. Well, should we play it? Well, we've got only, goodness, time has gone quickly. We've only got 10 minutes to go before the end of the show before Miss Annie comes in with her soul and R&B, old school,
yeah,
which is fantastic. And you're listening to Cowes Radio, 107.3 FM, coming to you from bustling downtown Occidental. And, yeah, just clearing up the market.
Traffic, right?
Yeah. There's at least one car at the stop sign.
It's like Point Reyes out there. Inside joke, sorry.
Indeed, indeed. So you've been, we've been listening, speaking to Steve Roby, a historian, lecturer, and archivist of Jimi Hendrix.
Yes. Please go to my website, steveroby.com, and there you can actually do a weekly podcast that you can download of some of the great things that we played tonight. You can sign up for the Woodstock Festival, West Fest, which is put on by 2B1 Records, coming up October 25th this year. And hopefully you'll be one of those 3,000 guitar players playing out there and making history.
Oh, that's going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great scene. You know, is everyone going to wear frizzy wigs?
I hope so. There should be also a amateur look-alike contest.
Oh, yeah. Definitely got to do stuff like that.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah. Well, let's throw some more music on the Barbie.
Okay. Let's get
before
cooking.
We run out of time here.
Your choice or mine? What?
No, yours. So let's. Oh. I love the rarities you're playing.
Well, since we were just talking about Purple Haze, let's play Purple Haze, track number 3. This goes back to November 10th, 1967. This is a Harlem TV show.
A Harlem?
Holland.
Oh, Holland. Sorry.
Sorry. My accent.
Except there is a Harlem in Holland, of course.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Okay.
With two A's. yes.
Ouch.
Yeah. Well, and...
A seconde. Nah, oh. Nu.
Oh, there was something just on the end there.
The announcer talking, you know.
Oh, of course, it was
Plug
Dutch.
Your ears, yeah.
Right. Well, we've been sitting with Steve Roby for 2 hours. Thank you very much, Steve.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
A wonderful experience to have Jimi Hendrix. Just an amazing run-through of his life and his achievements and some of the backstories. He's an incredible talent.
I think so, too.
So coming up, Miss Annie is in the studio, so just in a few minutes, we're going to be going soul and R&B. So hang on in there. So thank you very much, Steve.
Okay.
And we'll be signing off till next week's, next Friday, 7 to 9 p.m., and I'll be having Robin Fredericks, who is a...